You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Minutes after 8 here on the west coast of the United States. Mike McNamara with you. Toby Keith in studio. Not easy to do, but when you got a big budget for production, you could do stuff like that. Joining me, he's a contributing editor at SoftRep, Alex Hollings. Alex, how about Toby Keith in studio? How about that?
Hey, I'm pretty impressed, man. Things must be going well over there.
Things are looking up, man. All right, you're good for another 30 minutes, man. Take a break. He's a Southern guy, you know. He can take him off and go to sleep with no problem. First of all, Alex, we had Alex on last week, learned about his career and how he got into writing, and wanted to, now the part that I like is more the opinion piece, but Alex, former Sergeant, United States Marine Corps, and currently writes you can find his stuff at softrep.com. How exactly do they go to the website? How do they find what you write, Alex?
Well, you know, if you go to softrep.com, the top stories of the day will be, you know, listed right there at the top. And just about every day you can find at least one of my stories there. And if you click on my name, you can find everything I've written.
Okay.
Or if you scroll down the page a ways, there's a, you know, a big list of contributing writers, and you can find a picture of a very baby-faced Alex Hollings from back in my Marine Corps days. And if you click on that picture of me, you can also go ahead and find everything I've written.
Nice. All right. And they can. How do they find you on Twitter?
You can find me on Twitter. My name is literally just AlexHollings52 on Twitter.
Wow.
And you can find me on Facebook at AlexHollingsWriter.
Okay. Wow. You're yourself on Twitter. That rarely happens. You start looking for people on Twitter, you're like, good God, man. How was I supposed to know you were Monkey Killer 937 on Twitter? What the hell? So,
oh man. Well, you know, full disclosure, I probably had 4 or 5 Twitter accounts over the years, but I finally decided it was time to use my real name.
There you go. Cleaned up my act. I'm using my real name.
Yeah.
I'm curious. Marines United. Give me your thoughts on that. I say that because I'm really interested, because, you know, a lot of that stuff, if you grew up in, like, I'm a grunt. I spent very, very little time around female Marines professionally. And even in my, you know, non-fleet Marine Force tours, I went and was an instructor at the basic school. 95% male. We had females in some companies every once in a while, but, you know, 90% of my time, 95% of my time was spent not seeing women at work, not working with them, and then back to armor school, and then back to, you know, an infantry battalion. So I largely lived a life, you know, that was void of females. I'd see them, and I knew they were in the Marine Corps, certainly, but I didn't serve with them very often. That's not your life experience. So you have a different, and your experience is way more indicative of what most Marines experience than certainly mine was. It took me like 30 years to realize that my experience was an anomaly, that most of the Marine Corps wasn't like what I lived. It was much different. You lived in that world. Your thoughts on Marine United? Are you surprised at all by it?
Well, you know, I can tell you first and foremost that, you know, you're right. My experiences were very much different. Right from the get-go, when I was at combat training, my platoon wasn't co-ed, but there were 2 co-ed platoons in our company, which I believe may have actually been the first co-ed platoons that went through. So I saw a female Marine before I was even a full-fledged, you know, MOS-trained Marine. And then as an administrator, you know, like you said, there's a much higher population of female Marines in the administrative field than there are, I mean, obviously in combat arms, but even in a lot of other MOSs. So I dealt with a lot of, you know, senior-ranking female Marines right from the get-go. And I got to say, first and foremost, no, I'm not surprised by what's going on with Marines United. I suppose the thing that I am surprised about is, first of all, that they'd be so egregious And you know, honestly, behave in a way that's just blatantly embarrassing to the Marine Corps. But I'm also surprised that it didn't come from other branches first. I'm surprised that people were so shocked to find that sexism is an issue. And not necessarily because all Marines are sexist or anything like that at all, but just because, you know, anytime you've got an environment that has got a majority of, you know, let's say late teens, early 20s population, we're effectively talking college student age folks. You know, you amass 100,000 of them unified under any group. 10%, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with the 10% rule in the Marine Corps. 10% of any group is worthless, you know. So then when you take a group the size of the Marine Corps, there's going to be some bad guys, you know. And then when you surround them with other like-minded alpha individuals, which I'd argue most people join the Marine Corps because they have a bit of that alpha personality mindset.
I agree.
You create a supportive environment for things like that, you know, a supportive environment for hazing and stuff like that. And to be honest with you, I'm not actually intimately opposed to all forms of hazing. I'm actually one of those few guys that would argue that some kinds of hazing might even have a place in the military. But things like this, you know, they run counter to what we need to be an effective warfighting organization. We can't be eating our own, regardless of gender, you know? But because of my experiences, where coming up to the Marine Corps, some of the best leaders I had in the Marine Corps were, you know, seasoned female Marines. You know, female Marines that had been around for a long time, that got in the 70s and 80s, you know, or the 90s, when it was a tougher gig to be a female Marine, I'd argue,
man,
probably in that era, you know?
Man.
And but because of that, the really effective female Marine leaders that I knew were above reproach. You know, these were tough ladies who just oozed professionalism, I think in a lot of ways because they couldn't not. You know, you can't get away with being a crappy Marine and a female Marine for that long.
No, the stories they tell, you know, I've interviewed, some of the more interesting interviews I've done are with female Marines, and they pull back the curtain and give you a look into the world that they live in. I mean, it you look at it and you go, wow. Question, is going to work and being hit on simply a matter of course for a junior female Marine? Answer, yes.
I would agree with that.
By guys in your chain of command, outside your chain of command, and you constantly are having to evaluate, how is this going to affect me? If I say no, if I, you know, whatever I do, how will this affect me? And you think that that's just the landscape of their life as Marines.
To be fair to the subject, I think that there are some legitimate gripes and concerns coming from male Marines about the way female Marines are treated that benefits female Marines, but not as a whole. It might benefit individual female Marines. Because just like we said earlier, 10% of any group, you know, is effectively worthless. And that means 10% of female Marines as well. You know, just as a general rule of thumb, not every female Marine is a great Marine. And some of them are happy to take advantage of maybe that senior enlisted leader who, you know, will take it easy on her because he hits on her every day and things like that. But the female Marines that I knew and that I worked with and that I respected weren't that person. You know, they didn't want you to come over and offer to carry the saw on a ruck because they didn't want to be perceived as weaker.
Right.
They didn't want to be seen as someone who needed that help. So really, it was almost like a forced benefit. Like, they didn't want it, but, you know, older guys think that they're helping, you know, or, you know, other guys in their platoon think that they're helping by trying to be chivalrous, maybe. But you know, one thing that came up when the Marines United story first broke, and I started reaching out to people I knew who were still on active duty. You know, one Master Gunnery Sergeant that I have a lot of respect for, you know, I worked for him, you know, years ago, back when he was a gunny, you know, and I sent him a message on Facebook and said, you know, hey, man, what's it look like on the inside? You know, because we're hearing a lot about the perceptions that the outside world has.
Right.
And we're hearing a lot about, you know, these guys on Marines United who are, you know, proudly displaying their DD-214s to show that you can't touch them while they do this.
Right.
You know, what's it look like from the inside looking out? And what he told me is that there's a real problem with the way women are perceived in the Marine Corps. But to obviously to a lesser extent, there's also an issue with the fact that things really aren't, in an effort to make things more equal, things have become less equal. There are a lot of male Marines who are concerned about promotion because the PFT standards, for instance, are different, and the CFT standards are different, and arguably easier for a woman.
Right.
And I think that that doesn't lead directly to situations like Marines United, but it does speak to kind of the systemic difference in the genders that we need to try to combat.
You know? I, in speaking to guys, they have a bit of a chip on their shoulder because here's what they say. We're all supposed to be equal. We know that's bullshit. Okay? One, they're not interchangeable pieces, and whoever says that, you know, we have to stand in public and say that, but they're not. They can't pull their share of the weight physically. So when we do these things, we do part of their job and our job too. Two, there isn't one physical standard in the Marine Corps. There's two. It benefits them. And three, some take advantage of the gender thing for their own benefit, and then they get treated differently, and they're okay with that. And then they want to come back. And so you can see how this chip, you can see how this chip gets built on somebody's shoulder. They're pissed. They don't like it.
Absolutely. You know, and I would argue that although those female Marines were happy to take advantage of that female perception where maybe they're trying to get out of doing some of the work, or they're trying to take advantage of a relationship they have with someone of a senior rank, although they're a very small minority, they're hurting the good female Marines, not as much as maybe, you know, chauvinism among male Marines. I'm sure that's a larger issue. But that small minority of female Marines are having really far-reaching ramifications because all the male Marines around, you know, as you're coming up through the accession pipeline, if you're at your MOS school, and you see a female, you know, Marine who's going through school with you, you know, going out after classes are over with the staff sergeant who's one of the instructors, which is something I definitely saw at PA school, it's really difficult for you not to perceive these female Marines as different than you because there's nothing that I could do to get that staff sergeant to look at me as a peer or to talk to me as a human being. I'm effectively just out of recruit training, and all I am is a Marine to be molded, you know, in his mind. But this female Marine is going on dates with him. She was the one female Marine I'm talking about, was one female Marine I interacted with out of probably hundreds. But I'd be lying if I didn't say that it twisted my perception a bit early on. And if you experience enough of those things, you start to have, like, maybe a misconceived notion of what it is to be a female Marine. You know, you start to kind of imagine that it must be easier for them. Whereas in reality, it's probably not in most cases. I would argue that the physical fitness standards being a good point, I don't personally necessarily have a problem with female Marines doing the hang versus male Marines doing the pull-up, despite the fact that I don't love that.
Right.
I do have a real problem with, if, like, let's say, for instance, we're looking for new Marine raiders, and we really want to open all the combat MOSs to women, so we're really trying hard to find female Marines who can make it through this NDOC. When we start to lax those standards in order to ensure a certain number of female Marines get through, that's when I start to have a problem. I know female Marines that are tougher than me. I know plenty of female Marines who can jump on the pull-up bar and knock out 20 pull-ups. So the idea that we're going to reduce standards or relax standards to make sure that we have a certain percentage or to meet some political goals, I have a real issue with. I have no problem with women in combat arms, provided they pass all the same tests. You know, and that isn't chauvinism. It's literally just a matter of, you know, I'm a 225-pound guy. I need to know that you can pull me out of the line of fire if I get hit. If you're 130 pounds.
Alex, you know the fear that everybody has. If that's the situation as it ultimately came, then so be it. But and I'll use IOC as an example. There's guys that haven't been able to get through our infantry officer course, and they've gone on to other MOSs. You know, and it's not an easy course. And I would tell you that we produce the best infantry officers in the world, especially infantry second lieutenants. They're inexperienced in terms of actually doing it, but they are the best trained product that comes out of the factory. The fact that a woman can't get through it, does that mean we revise the training? And you
know, but see, I don't think so. I think it just means that the right women haven't pursued it yet.
Okay.
You know, there's no doubt in my mind that women are capable, that women are able to complete these courses. I think it's really a matter of, you know, maybe it's an internal recruitment push that we need to do, where we need to try to encourage women to pursue these things. I think that the social stigma that's associated with it, you know, you need to be a certain type of personality to want to be featured in an article on CNBC about being the first Marine female tank commander. That, I'm not saying that's a bad thing. That's a great thing.
Right.
But not every capable, physically fit, mentally fit female Marine wants to be that person. You know, so they're in a difficult predicament right now where, you know, it's highlighted in the media, it's highlighted in the press. So I think that we're probably getting a cross section of people who may be capable and fit, but are also, you know, willing to kind of weather that storm, or maybe even want to weather that storm. And until we can make it less of an issue where we're just taking the best possible candidates, not necessarily the ones that are okay with being on Good Morning America, it's going to be tough.
Right. You know, it's interesting. I had Major General Paul Kennedy on, who's a buddy of mine. He's a first lieutenant when I met him. I was a captain. We were teaching, and he now commands Marine Corps Recruiting Command. So he came on, and he said, you know, Mac, we never recruited women. We recruited men, you know. So if I had 100 Marines to recruit, 95 of those were going to be men. So how much effort am I going to put into recruiting women? And the answer is none. We recruited men. Women would come to us, and we would accept them. He said, that's not what we're doing anymore. We are now targeting different populations, women wrestlers, women rugby players, women who kind of skew to more physical, rougher, if you will, endeavors. Mixed martial arts fighters.
Well, you know, honestly, the same kinds of guys that we recruit.
Exactly.
As a guy,
exactly.
I was introduced to the Marine Corps playing college rugby. The two captains of my rugby team were Marines on the GI Bill. And the more I interacted with them, the more I was like, hey, you know what? I really feel like the system that they came from, the organization that they came from, seems like it'd be a good fit for me. And that was really what ended up pushing me towards it. When I dropped out of college, I ended up enlisting into the Marine Corps. I never even walked into an Army recruiter's office.
Right.
You know, I had already set my sights on it. You know, and to be honest, I'd like to point out, the best leader I've ever worked for, like the Marine that I most look up to, the female Marine. Her name's Chief Warrant Officer Sandy Alvarez. She's a Chief Warrant Officer 5 now. Toughest lady I probably ever met. She was all of, you know, maybe 5'4" and 140 pounds. And I once watched her choke out, you know, a 6'4" gunny when we were doing math. But she was aware of the fact that she was a woman, and she was happy to use that to her advantage. And I think that's what you need to do as a female Marine is, you know, she said when she's grappling, for instance, when she's doing ground fighting, she knows for a fact that that gunny that she's rolling with is going to be reluctant to go for the kill. And she says, you need to take advantage of that reluctance because that's his weakness, not mine. And I genuinely respect that mindset where she was aware of the perception of her and used it to her advantage, you know, tactically. That's exactly the type of female leader that I want to work for. You know, that's the type of leader I want to work for regardless of gender. Gender is, you know, notwithstanding whatsoever. The more female Marines we have like that in the Marine Corps, the better the Marine Corps will be. You know, but the same goes for male Marines. I'm sure you can attest to how many crappy male Marines did you work with or work for at some point in your career, but they don't have to be held to that standard of, oh, well, you know, it's a female Marine, so they've all got to be good. You know, there's plenty of crappy male Marines. You know, I worked with plenty of them, great guys even, some of them.
Right.
So, you know, the same standard goes both ways. I think the problem is that there are so many fewer female Marines that when one of them, if you'll excuse the expression, but when one of them sucks, it almost reflects on more of them than when one of us sucks.
You know, one of the interesting things that came out of, you know, first of all, just this gender integration task force was, you know, there was no standards really for becoming, I'll just use my MOS, for becoming an infantryman. If you completed the course and you could do 3 pull-ups and got through SOI, then you could go to the Fleet Marine Force. But now the requirements, if you're going to be, let's just say, an artilleryman, and to lift rounds, you know, X amount of rounds, you know, and put them on a truck in this amount of time. If you can't do that, you can't get the MOS. So the commanders of SOI East and West both told the commandant, and who relayed it when he was on the show, I can deliver you a higher quality product now because there is a standard. And a lot of the guys that have got through because of the pull-ups, and they would fail different things during the course, but that didn't eliminate them from the course if they could pass the PFT. So we gave you, really, guys who physically couldn't do it. Now, as we define this thing, what does it mean to physically be it, I think I can deliver you a higher candidate across the board, not just female, but male as well. So kind of interesting along the lines that you're saying about having standards and reluctance and things like that. Let me change gears. Give me a final comment about where do you think ultimately the Marines United thing takes the Marine Corps?
I think that it's a real black eye, you know, for the Marine Corps. Although, you know, there's been other groups that have been exposed in other branches. It was the Marine Corps that, you know, led the way when it comes to this. And I think that we're going to have to fight it, you know, in our culture, we're going to have to fight it internally, but we're also going to have to fight that perception that the Marine Corps is a sexist organization, you know, which a lot of people within the Marine Corps, male and female, even see it as such. I don't think that systemically the Marine Corps is a sexist organization. I think that there are individuals who have made bad decisions, on every level, you know, from top to bottom.
Right.
And we're still living the repercussions of those decisions. But I think this, like, you know, everything else that the Marine Corps has been faced with in the last, you know, 200 plus years, it's a bump in the road that we're going to have to overcome. But just like, you know, the flag raising at Iwo Jima, I always talk about, you know, this is the Marine Corps for the next 100 years. I forgot who exactly said it at the time. I'm blanking. But
Forrest also that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And, you know, because that's a constant concern that the Marine Corps has, is that we are not an indefinite fighting force. We exist only as long as we have the support of the American people, you know, Congress, the Senate, the executive branch. And when things like this happen, I think the Marine Corps does a good job of jumping right on the reactionary force, trying our best to adjust perceptions, trying our best to change the way that we behave in order to ensure the public is still on our side. I think that banning tattoos, for instance, in the recent years was an absolutely idiotic policy, but it was with that intent. It was trying to make sure that the American people stayed on the Marine Corps side in the face of some pretty bad press. Again, I don't even think that bad press was that bad. I don't care about a terrorist peeing on a Taliban sniper, you know, but some people did, you know, and we needed to work to address it. And I think we will with this again, just like, you know, now there's the concern about co-ed habitation in the barracks or in tents in the field. I think that's going to be a challenge. I think that we're going to address it. And I think that ultimately Marines are professionals and they're going to get past it. It'll probably be a bigger deal in the press than it is in the tent.
Interesting. Alex Holling is my guest here on a Tuesday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. And Alex, let me tee up another one for you. You wrote an op-ed piece about the Facebook comments in Syria. Tell me what that's about.
Well, you know, this happened prior to the Tomahawk strike on the air base in Syria that was under Assad's control. But just as some background, there was a chemical weapons attack in Syria that U.S. and a number of other countries, France, England, our intelligence all pointed to Bashar al-Assad, who's the president of Syria, giving the order to launch this chemical weapons strike that ultimately killed, close to 100 people, dozens of whom were children. And the narrative that, you know, because Russia, Vladimir Putin, supports Assad's regime, so the narrative that Russia and Syria immediately produced was that those chemical weapons weren't ours. You know, they belonged to these rebels, even though the rebels have never actually used chemical weapons against the Syrian government and have had them used against them a number of times. This time it was them, and we just accidentally blew up theirs. And, you know, there were a number of, you know, chemical weapons experts who came out in the press and said, you know, that story doesn't jive. You can't store sarin gas in a way that would allow it to mix and deploy because an explosion hit the warehouse that it's stored in. And because most sarin gas is stored in separate products that are kept away from one another, it becomes even less likely that that can happen, even if it were somehow chemically possible to mix the ingredients in just such a way to create sarin gas from an explosion. The problem comes in is, you know, kind of like the Facebook commenters. And I don't want to say that in a way that makes it sound like I don't want comments on my work. I love to receive the comments on my work. Some of them are crazier than others.
Right.
I think that people lose sight of the fact that, you know, like we mentioned last week, pop culture is really the lens that we look through when we're trying to see other places in the world that we've never been, like Syria, you know? And so Russia, being a great example in this last presidential election, is well aware of how perception matters much more than reality when it comes to things like voting. You know, so all Russia really needed to do was plant seeds to change perception, and that can change votes. You don't need to hack into a voting machine. You don't need to change paper ballots. You just need to change people's minds. And for the most part, you know, there's a couple of things that really play into their strength with this. The first is that a lot of Americans tend to not be very well informed. That's not anything bad against Americans. We're busy folks. We have time to read headlines. We have time to catch blurbs on TV. But, you know, then we're on to the next thing. But we tend to retain headlines. And, you know, there's been a number of studies that show if you read a headline, you may not necessarily remember the source that you got it from. It's called source amnesia.
Right.
But you will remember the fact and assume it was true. A good example of that is, do you happen to know a giraffe's tongue is black?
I do not.
You did not? All right. So it's a bad example for you. But for me, I know a giraffe's tongue is black, but I don't know where or when or how I learned that. Somewhere along the way, you know, I picked up that fact, but I have source amnesia as to where I learned it. Now, if it turns out that fact is something like, you know, Donald Trump hates women, the fact may not have a basis, but I know that fact because I picked it up somewhere, and maybe it came from CNN or maybe it came from sarah.blogspot.org, but I don't remember where it came from. I just remember the fact. Americans especially are susceptible to this because we have so much media inundating us all the time. So if you can sneak enough stories in about Hillary Clinton's emails, which I think actually was a big deal that we kind of laughed off, same with Benghazi, was a very big deal that they managed to make like a PR joke. But if you can plant enough of these misgivings, you don't have to change a vote. You just have to change your mind. Which is really easy because we tend to like things that support our pre-existing notion. I didn't like Hillary Clinton, so I was happy to read about how bad she was. You know, the real challenge is trying to read things from opposing viewpoints so that you can try to shape, you know, a better rounded idea, which, you know, it's easy for a guy like me because it's my job.
Right.
It's not that easy for someone who's already working 60 hours this week, you know, and has two kids to take care of. And, you know, their car needs an oil change, and they've got a lot on their mind, and they have maybe 10 minutes to catch the news. And they're not even that interested because it's the news and they're making dinner right now, but they pick up a few things, and those things end up informing how they vote or the way they participate in online conversations. And those online conversations kind of bridge that gap between the digital realm where it's just Facebook and who cares, and it's how you actually interact with the world. You carry it over in your brain. You know, and then when it comes time to vote, you might think that Donald Trump was trying to start a war with Syria or with Russia by launching those missiles at that airbase. I think it's probably more along the lines of he was trying to make a very calculated move that would show there were repercussions for Assad's actions without leading to war. You know, but it's easy for me to say that because I've read, you know, 80,000 words on the subject. It's harder for you to glean that when all you caught was a headline on NBC.
Alex Holling from SoftRep continues with us. Is there a solution for that problem? Because it's been an age-old problem. The way we consume the media continues to change as technology changes. And I read a very interesting article after the election, I guess right towards the, you know, as the election got near, and it was about teenagers in Macedonia that were making money off fake news, and they talked about how much money they had made. They were making $60,000 a year, several of them, And all they were doing was planting fake news stories. And they said, you know, obviously the top targets are Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And so Hillary Clinton, Benghazi, Hillary Clinton email, anything. And if you can get something to go viral, that's how you make really, really good money. And somebody said, well, what about the fact that it's not true? And the one kid said, why does that matter to me? All I'm doing is making a living. I don't care if it's true. And that seems to line up kind of perfectly with the way we consume the media now, which is if it does go viral, if somebody, you know, puts that link onto a feed that has, you know, hundreds of thousands of people on it, that thing has legs now. And it's a part of the quote-unquote news that we see on a daily basis. Is there a solution for that? Or is a solution that, as a consumer, you're going to get tired of this stuff? And you're going to, at some point, move to quality, find a place that provides quality news coverage. Your thoughts on that?
Well, first and foremost, you're 100% right. I keep saying first and foremost. But you are 100% right that the only way to fix it is for people to demand better quality. But I think that the only difference between those guys in Mongolia who are like, what's the difference to me if it's true or not? And some of the journalists in the United States, you know, I hate to just rag on one outlet because I know for a fact that there are good writers that work for the worst outlets and vice versa. But the difference between Mongolian guys just shooting out fake news to make a paycheck and that guy at BuzzFeed who's doing the same is that they're honest about it in Mongolia. You know, here we'll try to pretend that it's journalistic integrity that forced me to leak these documents that are entirely unsubstantiated. Or we'll tell people that we just want to make sure that the public is as informed as they possibly can be. But the reality is, a lot of guys here stateside, or, you know, in the Western world, in Europe and stuff as well, you know, the Mirror is a great example of that over in England.
Right.
They'll run just anything that they think is going to get legs, regardless of whether or not you can validate it. But they'll pretend that they're doing it as a service to you, which is even more dangerous, you know, because it's easy, you know, once you get a little bit of practice at it, to go, all right, what's the web address that I got this story from? You know, who's the writer? Is it unaccredited? Is it on a website I've never heard of? Are there spelling errors? Things like that are usually really good indicators that this is crap. This is not legitimate news. At the very least, it's probably not a very good source, you know. But then when you get it from, you know, outlets with a really wide distribution net, like the Times, who kept reporting that Russia was moving hundreds of thousands of troops to the North Korean border, which was not accurate at all. But they reported it for a week straight because it just kind of like increased this fervor of this idea that World War III is going to jump off at any moment.
Right.
When in reality, we're just dealing with like a really complicated geopolitical debate. You know, I'm not going to say it could never turn to violence, but right now we're not on the cusp of war, no matter what CNN wants to tell you. You know, we're maybe three or four steps removed.
No, let me tell you, the Situation Room, is that place crazy or what?
You know, I don't know. I watch these things on TV. You know, I read these articles. It's really hard sometimes. Donald Trump is probably the one politician that I have ever been more unsure of exactly what's going on in that White House than anyone else.
Right.
I think in large part because, you know, to be perfectly honest with you, I'm not even a huge Donald Trump fan,
right.
But I do think that he gets a really unfair shake in the press. You know, even a broken clock is right twice a day, but they won't even give him that. You know, so if you really don't like Donald Trump, you assume it's just a couple of guys sitting around a room, you know, planning to overthrow, anyone who's got liberal-leaning orientation in the United States. But the reality of the matter is that it's probably a group of hardworking people trying their best. That's all any organization is, you know? But I have no idea, man. I wonder sometimes, because you hear these stories about him getting fewer intelligence briefings because he doesn't trust his sources or because he's too busy. And I can't tell all the time whether or not, is this just the way that they're portraying his presidency? Because I'm not there in the White House, you know?
Right.
Or is it true? Is this guy really not interested in hearing from all of the sources that he has available to him? If that's the case, I'm concerned.
Right.
You know, so it could be real busy in there, or it might not be that busy at all. I hope it's busy.
All right, Alex, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk about what, five ways to improve my Glock without breaking
you
the
You got button. It, man.
So my guest this morning from SoftRep.com, you can find his work there, is a former Marine Sergeant Alex Hollings. So we're going to take a quick break. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on the only place that you'll find All Marine Radio. That is right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. So whatever you do, stand by. Don't touch that dial. More of this program coming up next.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner. Proven and dependable.
I'm good, but I have a story and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in the crowd.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I still have nightmares.
I'm really not so good. But are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
More than 2 million Americans have served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the Department of Veterans Affairs reports that approximately 11 to 20% of those warriors may have experienced symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. As we recognize PTSD Awareness Month, Real Warriors Campaign volunteer Meg Mitchum, a former Army combat medic who served in Iraq, encourages fellow warriors to reach out when they need help.
The hardest step was admitting that I needed help coping with PTSD. Once I did, my command and unit fully supported me, and I was able to get the care I needed. Getting support helped me succeed in the military and now in my civilian career.
If you or a loved one is coping with an invisible wound, resources are available and they work. For more information, visit the Real Warriors campaign at realwarriors.net or call 866-966-1020.
My name is Juan Perez, Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer, but I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly the special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our way of living, our quality of life? The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold. Be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there with folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global Soft Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
On Veterans Day, the nation honors the men and women who risk their lives to protect our freedom. Social Security does its absolute best to honor veterans and active duty members of the military every day by giving them the respect they deserve. For those who return home with injuries, Social Security is a resource they can turn to. If you know any wounded veterans, please let them know about Social Security's Wounded Warriors website. The Wounded Warriors website answers many commonly asked questions and shares other useful information about disability benefits, including how veterans can receive expedited processing of disability claims. Learn more by visiting www.socialsecurity.gov/woundedwarriors.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. 8:46 on a Tuesday. Mike McNamara with you. Armory Radio continues, and we continue with from Soft Rep, Alex Hollings. So, Alex, first of all, thanks for doing this morning. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me. This is great.
So first of all, are you a Glock guy?
You know, I never was. I've been a 1911 guy for years and years and years. I'm old school. I love my 1911. But, you know, not too long ago, I stumbled across a Gen 3 Glock 19, you know, for sale on clearance at my local gun shop here. And I was like, you know what? I work with all these, you know, special operations guys who love their Glocks, their 17s and their 19s. You know, what the heck? Give it a shot. You know, it's the only way I can ever know for sure. And I have slowly but surely fallen in love with this gun over the last 6 months. You know, it's become my everyday carry.
So you're not a 1911 guy anymore? What a sellout!
You know, I think that I would compare it to, you know, growing up in the racing industry. You know, there's a lot of Ford guys and there's Chevy's guys. You know, just like blondes and brunettes. And I'd always argue that if you jump right out the door saying that you're going to ignore one whole half of the group, you're just making it like twice as likely you're going to have a lame Saturday night. You know, you got to give blondes and brunettes a try. You got to give Fords and Chevys a try, and you got to give 1911s and Glocks a try. You know,
wow.
There's good and bad.
Hold on. Can I tell you about that? That was spoken.
Okay.
Spoken like a sellout. Okay. Come on, you. I respect your ability to rationalize. So the 1911, that's like a man's weapon, man. Come on.
Well, I got to say, and I do love my 1911. You know, I used it as my concealed carry piece for years.
Yeah.
But I got to tell you, you know, now I'm getting older. I've been building these love handles out of good steak, and I don't want to chew them up anymore with the dovetail in my 1911. And my little Glock 19 tucks right in under the love handle without any problems. Like,
you
can
know
sit down in my car.
I can respect that. I can respect that. I didn't buy the other long-winded roundabout. This is before, but when you like say, hey, look, man, I'm becoming a fat man, and the Glock has a lower profile, it works for me. I respect that completely.
Squeezes right in. Nothing's getting pinched. But no, honestly, you know, I recently, for an article, I went to the range with, you know, my American Classic 1911 that I've had for years, my Glock 19, and a High Point 9mm, just as a basis of comparison. And what I really found is, to be honest with you, in my hands, the 1911 is more accurate. You know, like a lot of right-handed shooters, I found that the Glock, especially early on, I tend to impact the target low and left of center,
right.
You know, and it took a lot of adjustment to get me kind of into the black the way I want it to be.
Right.
But there's a lot of things that the Glock offers the 1911 doesn't, and one of those is the high level of modifiability, you know. Again, to compare it to being a car guy, a Glock's like a Honda Civic. When you first buy it, it's not necessarily anything special. But, you know, you can make it whatever you want it to be, depending on how much money you're willing to throw at it. And I would argue that when I bought my Glock for $400 or what have you, my 1911 was the superior firearm in my hands. But, you know, over the last couple of months, fiddling with it here and there, adding some parts to it, getting better with it, I'm getting to the point now where I'm probably just as good a shooter with either weapon, and that's really where I'd like to be. I'd like to be in a position where I can grab either one and not have to worry about my accuracy, you know, and nothing I can do for that but just keep sending more rounds downrange.
All right. Spoken like a qualified fat man. All right. Now, first of all, Alex, are you non-PT-er now? You're just, like, totally committed to being a fat guy or what?
No. You know, I'm still working out all the time. I spent the last 2 days hiking out in Tennessee. So right now I'm feeling like a fat guy because it turns out I'm not as tough as I used to be. I thought 15 miles would be a breeze, and turns out my feet hurt, man. But I wouldn't say that I'm full on. I'm heading towards the diabetes train. But it gets tougher, you know, as you get older. You know, I'm 5 surgeries deep, and my knees don't work the way I want them to anymore. So now I have to sit on the recumbent bike next to the old ladies at the gym instead of hitting the pavement like I wanted to. You know,
don't get on the recumbent. Get on like another form of stationary bike. But the recumbent, man, that is the home of the obese. That's where you're headed, man.
I'm telling you, if you want to watch The View with a 60-year-old lady named Gladys, there's no better seat than from a recumbent bike.
That's the whole kit, man. And see, it's not the recumbent bike that's the issue. It's everything that goes with it, right?
Yeah, no, it's 100% true. I mean, I'm a weightlifter by trade. That's my thing. You know, that's how I gained a lot of weight in the Marine Corps. So cardio, a lot of times cardio is an afterthought for me.
On,
I know
cardio,
that's terrible.
What
but,
is that? Come on.
But I go to the gym to lift, and then I do the cardio just to make sure I get to keep my feet. You know, I don't want the diabetes to come get me. So, but, you know, if I'm there for an hour, it's 45 minutes of lifting and 15 minutes of me just begrudgingly sitting on that bike. You know?
All right. All right. Back to Glocks. Give me the five improvements that you can make. What are they?
Well, you know, the first five improvements that I need to mine, the first one, the most important one that you need to do when you buy a Glock is you need aftermarket sights. I know Glock guys are not willing to accept that anything could be wrong with their beloved firearm, but the stock plastic sights that come on a Glock are just not very good. You know, especially if you want to try to shoot anything from outside of 25 meters. Inside of 25 meters, you know, you can get away with the stock sights without much trouble. But once you try going outside that, those plastic sights are really going to let you down. And God help you, if you drop it, and, you know, on rough terrain, you're going to scratch or gouge those plastic sights up. So the first thing that I did was I put some Iridium night sights, some TrueGlow night sights on it that are metal. You know, they've got a great look to them. You know, you can really easily acquire the target, even in, like, a really dark room. Like I said, you know, I was out in Tennessee for these last couple of days, and I carry a firearm in my pack just because you never know what you'll run into.
Right.
And I can tell you that you could honestly, you know, see the sights on my Glock, even though you couldn't see the weapon. It was so dark. So I definitely recommend them. They run you, like, $140. It's the most expensive thing you'll have to do to your Glock, but it is worth it.
All right.
You know, after that, you know, the next thing that I did was I put in a tungsten weighted guide rod. You know, when you do that, you'll have to replace the spring. It'll only run you like $50. You can get them at places like the Glock store. And what it does is it just kind of reduces the muzzle flip. You know, and going from a 1911, you know, going from shooting 45 to 9 mil, the recoil is already significantly reduced. But then when you go with that heavy tungsten guide rod, the muzzle flip goes away, and rapid fire, like retarget, like, you know, reacquiring your target,
right,
becomes much easier. Right. And get tighter groups, faster groups. It's really worth it. It's the kind of thing that you may not notice the benefit unless you've already put 1,000 rounds through it, maybe. But the benefit's definitely there.
Okay. All right. That's two. Give me three.
The third one would be, like, your extended slide release. And I'll lump this other one in with it, magazine release button as well. On the standard Glock, you know, I'm not a little guy, you know, I'm 6 feet tall. I can reach the magazine release button with my thumb, but not with enough force to really press it to do a speed reload with keeping my hand in the firing position.
Right.
So getting that extended mag release button will really speed up your reload times. It'll help you stay firing faster, you know, reduce the amount of time that you're without your weapon to protect you. And the extended slide release is honestly just because it makes it that much easier to break the gun down. You know, the stock slide release is pretty small, you know, especially if you're the kind of guy like me that works on my car a lot. My fingers usually hurt, you know. So having that little bit of extra material on the slide release makes it a lot easier to engage it.
Yeah, I don't know why that isn't standard equipment on that weapon, because it just, I mean, come on. I've got to have an elongated thumb in order to make that happen. So I've always wondered why you had to be able to reach a little bit. If you're an average, like I'm 5'9 3/4. So, I mean, I shouldn't have to. I'm pretty average in terms of height. I shouldn't have to extend my thumb, you know, to hit that release. So I've always wondered why.
I can reload and keep firing much faster with my 1911. The magazine capacity may be half that of the 9mm, but I can probably, like, once reloading comes into play, the 1911 starts gaining on my Glock, you know? But that said, hopefully with this extended button, you know, I'm not going to run into that problem anymore. And I know 1911 guys would argue, well, you shouldn't have to, you know? And I agree. Don't get me wrong. But, you know, to be fair, the Generation 4, you know, Glock 19, I haven't fired yet. And maybe they've worked some of that out. There was a lot of little tweaks from the Gen 3 to the Gen 4. You know, I've got a buddy with a Gen 4 Glock 17 where, you know, I was pulling it apart and playing with it the other day. And I was really impressed by some of the little things that you, you might not have asked for, but you're happy to see, you know. And with, you know, the Glock 19 and 17 MOSs, I don't know if they have it in every other model, but, you know, they have the new models that are out that are built intentionally for you to be able to put different types of optics on. I think it's another great improvement on the system, you know. I think that if I had maybe a Gen 4 or 19 MOS, I might even like it more than with my Gen 3 regular old Glock 19. Because it seems like, you know, they really do have an eye on improving the shooting experience, you know, and, you know, the more models come out, the better it is. And that is one thing it's kind of got over the 1911. I love the 1911 because it's historical. But they're not updating it anymore. You know, they're not improving it.
Right.
One would argue they don't need to as much, perhaps. But you know, I like having, like, my 1911 is the 68 Charger and my Glock is, you know, the 350Z. I like having each of them.
All right, give me number four.
Let's see here. I'm looking at my article now because I don't even remember anymore.
That's okay.
You know, a mass grade barrel is another great addition. It's another one that's a little bit pricier. It'll probably, you know, a decent one will run you a little over $100. You can, obviously, the sky is the limit. I don't think that a lot of shooters will probably see a definitive improvement in accuracy by switching to a mass grade barrel, only because the difference in how accurate you are inside of 25 meters from barrel to barrel is fairly negligible, you know, unless you're an expert shooter.
Okay.
But what you will find is that the steel the mass grade barrel is used out of is thicker where the round actually loads into the barrel. And what that means is that the firearm is going to hold up longer, it'll take more abuse. If you're not great about cleaning your weapon as often as you should, which you should be, and there's no excuse for that, but if you're not as good at it, it's going to handle more rough and tumble firing with crappier ammo. It'll shoot for you longer without you ever having to worry about it. Right, now, if you're the type of person that goes shooting three times a year, it might not be valuable to you.
Right.
But if you go every week, you know, it really could come in handy.
All right, give me number five.
The fifth one is something to sticky up your grip. You know, 1911 guys are quick to talk about how Glocks are made out of plastic like it's a bad thing. I kind of see that as a good thing in some ways. It makes them rugged and resilient. Your dog might chew it up, so keep it away from them. But other than that, you know, they hold up real well. But the grip will get slippery on you if you are shooting in the hills of Georgia, as I tend to. And, you know, it's real hot, it's real humid.
Right.
You get a couple hundred rounds down range, and your palm starts to get sweaty, and that plastic will slip on you. And even if you're still accurate, you kind of lose that confidence that you would be otherwise. So, you know, they make, for $4, you can buy like a grip sticker that you can put on it. I chose to go with like a leather grip cover, just because, you know, I like the way it looked and felt. Some guys use a Dremel tool and just kind of chew up the plastic, on their Glock handle, which costs nothing, you know.
Right.
But it can go far in keeping you feeling confident in the grip that you have on the firearm. And making sure that you're going to deliver rounds downrange to exactly where you want, as opposed to kind of where it might have jumped around in your hand because it was wet.
How about that? All this in 1 hour? That's pretty unbelievable, man. You're like a production, a media production machine.
I talk fast is really what I think it is. You know, I spend a lot of time in my office by myself. You give me a chance to talk to somebody.
You do talk fast, just so you know. I was listening a little bit ago. I'm like, man, he's a fast talker, man. This is awesome. All right. Well, first of all, Alex, I love having you on, man. I hope you don't mind every couple of weeks if I give you a call and come on and talk about your work here on All Marine Radio. And then on occasion when news breaks and there's subjects, you know, that we'd be expected to address, which is kind of the expectation of creating a live broadcast, that you'll come on and contribute your voice, because I love our culture. I love the ethos that comes with it, whether we're talking about Marines United, and I think the Commandant exemplified a bit of that, which is he went in front of Congress, in front of the Senate and House Armed Service Committees, took his face shots and said, "I'll fix this." And I love that.
He really, you know, and he accepted responsibility, which I really love to see.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you what.
You know?
And there's something that you have to respect about somebody who goes out there and just takes face shot after face shot after face shot and sits there and says, "I know, I'll fix it, I'll fix it." And I'll tell you what, he was my battalion commander. And if he tells you he's fixing it, he's fixing it. And so it'll be interesting to see how he gets after this. I know they made some modifications to the UCMJ, or they're coming shortly. No, they made some modifications to the Navy regulations that says specifically about moving images. But anyway, but I hope you don't mind if I contact you and ask you to come back on, because
I'd be happy to.
You on, man.
I really
love
would.
Having. All right, what's the next thing you're going to write? What are you writing about today?
I'm in the middle of working on a story about the May Day protests going on over in Portland, and the arrests that 25 people were arrested, because I think maybe some of those protesters went out there because they wanted to participate in the conversation, but it seems pretty clear that a good number of them went literally just because they were hoping to start trouble, you know. And when you go and when you throw Molotov cocktails at the police because you're trying to initiate political change, that's terrorism. That's not a protest, you know. I think that if their group does have some real meaningful things that they want to impart, they're going about it the wrong way. I'm working on a story right now that kind of speaks to that.
Yeah, let me just tell you, disturbing, and then I'll let you go. Disturbing is that conservative speakers can't go to Berkeley, California, which was supposedly a bastion of free speech and liberal thinking, but a conservative speaker can't go there because there's going to be a riot that busts out. And this kind of stuff in May Day. Look, we're all about a diverse, inclusive conversation, right? But when violence is that's going to be the course of action, then you need your ass kicked. So hopefully the police or somebody will do it. But this stuff is ridiculous. But just me.
I agree. You can only claim the moral high ground for so long when you behave this way.
Right.
As a person who tries really hard to pull myself out of that right versus left argument, when you look at it from the outside objectively, a lot of these guys on the left that present themselves as though they have the moral high ground because, they're more socially liberal, which there's nothing wrong with being socially liberal if that's your bag. But, you claim that you're all inclusive. You claim that you're trying to defend the rights of people who can't speak up on their own behalf. But then when other people try to impart their views, it's met with violence. And that's exactly what they claim to be opposed to.
I know. It's like, what are we stupid? Come on, man. That's like ESPN. Come on, man.
I actually, when I was in high school, and the first Iraq invasion jumped off, a bunch of people in my school immediately organized a Books Not Bombs walkout, right? And being the mouthy captain of the football team that I was, I immediately staged an anti-protest protest so that people who didn't want to be a part of that group could still skip school with a legitimate excuse. As I was walking around the school putting up my anti-protest protest flyers, a girl named Emily, I won't say her last name, but one of the organizers of the initial walkout, came over and started choking me to get me to stop putting up my flyers.
Nice.
Which was, even at 17 years old, I was like, how hypocritical is it of you to claim that you're staging an anti-violence protest, and as soon as you're met with a little bit of, of an opposing view, you don't know how to respond other than to just try to fight me like it's third grade. And what am I going to do? I'm not going to hit her back. I just, kind of laughed it off and walked away. But I think that we're seeing that same thing time and time again, especially after this last election and now right up through May, going on in Portland.
All right. Alex, first of all, thanks for the time this morning. The fastest talker ever on All Marine Radio, Alex Hollings. Enjoy.
Yeah, I'll have to work on that.
No, it's awesome, man. I love it. You're like a speed talker. Seinfeld's going to do an episode about you at some point.
Maybe I should have gone into auctions instead of journalism.
No, it's great. All right, man. Thanks for the visit.
Hey, thanks a lot, man. Have a great day.
All right. Alex Hollings from Soft Rep, former Sergeant, United States Marine Corps, and the fastest talker here on All Marine Radio. Joining us next will be Mike Musselman. So whatever you do, don't touch that dial.